Head. Arguing for Ms. Head is John D. Hyland. Counsel?
Your Honor, thank you. I am John Hyland, Marcus Berghahn, and I appear to advocate on behalf of Ms. Head. Counsel, may it please the court. Ms. Head was convicted in Rock County Circuit Court of first-degree intentional homicide related to the death of her husband, Harold Head, on May 29, 1998. At trial, Ms. Head attempted to assert self-defense and met with obstacles at every course. Now, in the briefs before you and at trial, much was made of the fact that Harold Head did not have a weapon at the time that Mrs. Head fired two shots which ended his life. Harold Head did not need a weapon in order to control, intimidate, or dominate Deborah Head. Throughout 22 years of marriage, Harold Head used his body, his strength, his size in comparison to her, to intimidate, control, and dominate her. Harold Head, according to the autopsy testimony, was 6 feet tall and 278 pounds. The jury obviously had an opportunity to view Mrs. Head and her size, and I'm not sure it's clear from the record, that she was a considerably smaller person than he, perhaps as much as a third of his weight. Harold Head used his body throughout their marriage, and he used threats throughout their marriage to intimidate and to control her. It started, according to her testimony in a proffer to the court, with his repeated remarks that if she ever attempted a divorce, he would kill her. And in fact, that began when she had investigated the possibility of a divorce early in their marriage, and he learned of it, and he made that threat, and he repeated that threat, according to her testimony, each and every time the subject of anybody else's divorce came up, not that they spoke of divorce. He reinforced this threat, he reinforced this fear. She testified on an almost weekly basis through twisting her arm, through pinching or twisting her breasts, and through picking her up by the armpit, each act causing pain, causing her to cry at times, causing bruising at times. It is true, he never hit her. He never shoved her, he never punched her, although he did throw her physically such that she hit a couch and needed medical attention, and chased her on one occasion, she testified, so that when they both fell onto a bed, the bed frame broke. He destroyed property, he threw things, he threw temper tantrums. Deborah Head also knew of personally, or had been told by Harold or others, of other acts which he had committed, acts of temper, acts of violence, acts of acting out, imposing his will on others. Deborah testified in her proffer that Harold took medication at one point during their marriage and things were better, but unfortunately in 1998, when he learned of his daughter's pregnancy, when he became irate over that fact, and when later in May of that year they argued in the bedroom, he was not on such medication. But throughout their lives, there's a pattern that is important to this self-defense assertion that Deborah had made at trial that was rejected. This assertion that McMorris evidence would support, and that is that Harold Head does not need weapons to inflict fear upon her. On May 29th, that morning, she was in a t-shirt and panties in their small bedroom discussing finances when she raised the subject of their daughter's pregnancy, a subject which she testified had caused him on each and every occasion to go into a violent rage, such that he went out the first time when he learned it and sought to actually do harm to the person he was informed was the father. That morning, he ranted again about this person named Chad, and he accused Deborah of instigating the pregnancy and hiding it from him, of not doing her job as a mother to keep their daughter from becoming pregnant. And then he decided and said, maybe I'd be better off if I just took care of both of you and got on with my life, and threw the covers back. And it was at that moment that his body as a weapon was important. It was at that moment that she had a fear for her safety, and she grabbed a gun that she thought he was going to go for. The exhibits, the pictures that have been brought to the court this week from the clerk of courts, demonstrate both the weapon that was used in this offense and also the weapons that surrounded the walls of this room, this small, tight bedroom. Opposing counsel will be introducing and having you look at an exhibit showing the diagram of that space, but I propose that exhibit number 19, a photograph, really shows the true cramped quarters in that room where Deborah had faced her husband that morning.
Now, counsel, just from a factual standpoint, since you've been going through that, at no time did the deceased get out of the bed. He was As I understand it, he was in the bed. There were some covers on at least part of the body, and he had one leg out. Is that correct?
Your Honor, that is correct. When the sheriffs entered the room, they observed his right leg out of the bed, and that's seen in the photographs that are supplied to you. The bed covers had been still covering his left leg. They were pretty much off of his torso area. There was maybe some confusion about a blanket, but that was placed on the body after he had been shot by Mrs. Head to control blood flow. He was not covered up.
So if this court would adopt the, say, the McMorris test and use that, you know, the McMorris, and then this is before the trial judge, just what the evidence here would be that there were guns in the room, many guns, 26 guns.
That's correct.
Something like that. And that the deceased, they had quarreled. She had the gun, and she fired two shots. But he never left the bed. Is that...
I think the evidence would be, Your Honor, that she fired two shots as she perceived him getting out of the bed. In other words, he was not laying prone in the bed at the time she
fired. He had one leg out of it. Okay.
Yes. And at trial, she testified that moments before the shooting, his attitude changed briefly and he appeared terrified. And much of that was made in the trial, in closing arguments, and in the briefs before you.
Did both bullets strike him?
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
Where did the first one strike him? Do you know?
The first one, I believe, struck near the heart, but the pathologist was unable to determine which actually was the initial exit.
And where was the second?
In the gut, in the stomach area.
Mr. Hyland, do you think it's valid to draw a distinction between whether there might have been justification to have her pick up the gun and whether there was or was not justification to fire the gun? How do you get from it's all right for her to have the gun in her hand to protect herself to the point where she's able to fire the gun twice at the victim?
Your Honor, I justified by looking at the continuum of what occurred, as well as the knowledge in her state of mind of his past behavior, the actual McMorris evidence at issue. In other words, she was justified in picking up the gun because of the verbal threat he had made and because she knew in the past that he would act physically towards her. And she was justified in firing the gun when, in the face of the gun, he continued to move, she believed, to come at him.
Well, under Camacho, the Camacho case, don't we have to look at both subjective and an objective test? And I can understand perhaps the argument under the subjective test, but I'm having difficulty understanding the justification for firing under an objective test.
Well, first, Your Honor, I understand the elements identified in Camacho, and I understand how they come into play at the time when jury instructions are requested. I'm not certain that this court has ever said that they come into play in determining whether McMorris evidence can be introduced, when the only thing the court has said is a sufficient factual basis must be established. Our argument to you is to adopt much more of a standard akin to a preliminary hearing in a criminal case, where the defendant simply has the burden of producing a plausible factual version that would lead to a belief that a jury might find self-defense. Not that they would, but that they might. That, in other words, it is worth considering placing that before them once all the evidence is heard. Part of the problem is that this issue of McMorris comes up during trial before the court has heard everything. And I don't believe it's appropriate for the court to have to take a jury instruction view or an elements of the offense view and find that each and every objective standard is met when the defendant at that point simply has the burden of production, the burden of producing some facts justifying the eventual submission of self-defense.
You've seen the state's letter of October 4th.
Yes, I have, Your Honor.
View that as agreeing with you as to this preliminary review of the McMorris evidence?
The state reserves its position that this objectively reasonable basis remains.
That. But as to the procedure?
As to the procedure, certainly the trial court should take a proffer before or during trial as it did here. I think what's significant, and I think what the state carries the burden now, is to point to something in the trial court's decision which shows that it indeed considered the McMorris evidence, which they concede can be considered, in determining whether the McMorris evidence should be introduced.
Counsel, in reading the Assistant Attorney General's October 4th letter, it seems that we just start on page 36 of their brief. I was sitting here thinking that a lot of the questions that maybe I would have asked you, I no longer will ask you. But
I appreciate that.
Maybe everyone. Don't you being set up. The comments that you just made caused me to think of the amicus brief. The amicus brief, as I understand it, and at first attacks the Camacho opinion, says it should be overruled. Its fallback position is, okay, if you need both subjective and objective, now I'm getting to my point, that an actual intent is sufficient to establish a prima facie case of objective. Do you read their amicus brief that way or don't you?
Yes, I do.
Now, is that your argument?
It is, to the extent that a prima facie case does not have to reach the same burden that the defense has in requesting instructions at the end of trial, and that the court must apply at that point.
Let me ask, just for clarification, I understood, at least in part, your argument to be that under the facts of this case, and given the acceding by the state, that you, under the total circumstances, that you are meeting the objective test if you look at the offer of proof. That's what I understand you to be arguing, as opposed to the amicus, which is arguing an actual belief is sufficient to establish a prima facie case. Now, do you understand the distinction that I'm making? And if so, perhaps you could elucidate.
I do. And while I still maintain that the objective standard should not come into play in the same way as the state argues for McMorris decisions, I believe that if you look at the trial court's decision, certainly the trial court did not reach a decision upon that basis, did not even consider or use terminology which would reflect a consideration that the objective viewpoint had been weighed or not weighed, had been considered or not considered. The trial court's decision presents multiple problems, especially in light of the concession of the state. Both the fact that if you examine those pages of remarks by Judge Werner, you cannot find where he considered this history in making his decision that McMorris evidence would not be admitted, although he said on the record that one of his considerations is the evidence that's been produced. But not only that, his focus, after reviewing all of the case law that had been presented to him and that he found, his focus was not on the defendant, was not on the defendant's state of mind, but was on what the victim was doing at the time. And that is not the test that is to be applied. The court said in this particular matter, the court heard the offer of proof, and the important portions of the offer of proof, as far as the particular motion is concerned, is that on the day before Mr. Head was killed, and then he went through the recitation of those facts, and ultimately said, look, all these cases, the case law state that the victim is armed, making an armed threat, simultaneously acting in violence, and that wasn't present here, so of course there's no self-defense. And that is the most important reason this decision and this case needs to be reversed, because the trial court did not apply the correct standards in determining whether McMorris evidence could be introduced. Both that standard, which is now conceded by the state, that the past actions can be considered in determining the defendant's state of mind, and the what Judge Rogensack identified in the crux of her dissent, that the limitation on the facts Deborah was able to produce did not meet that burden. As I said, I believe that the court's decisions on McMorris have left you an opportunity to really define this for trial courts in the future, to set forth what you meant when you said that the defendant must establish a sufficient factual basis. And I think that that is akin to the burden of the proof needed at a preliminary hearing. And there are many parallels that support that. The fact that not all of the evidence is produced at a preliminary hearing, the fact that not all the evidence has been received at a trial when McMorris decisions are made, the fact that the burden at a preliminary hearing is much less and is just to establish that there are plausible facts that justify the case going forward, and for a defendant offering McMorris, the fact that she has to establish plausible facts justifying self-defense. And in this case, the plausible facts were presented to the trial court when she testified as to the history and as to her fear that morning, her state of mind based upon that history.
Well, the preliminary doesn't require you very much.
No, it doesn't.
No gauge of credibility.
That's correct, and in this determination, in the McMorris determination, I don't believe the trial court should be gauging credibility either, especially if you adopt at least part of what the state is arguing, the evidence should be viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant offering it, which I also am not certain the trial court satisfied in his analysis.
Well, just exactly what would go to the, what you're proposing under McMorris, which would go to the jury. The judge has to make some. You have a hearing, it's a motion in limine, and then what?
And the judge's determination at that point is it plausible? And it goes towards the ultimate decision of could a jury find self-defense? But it is...
So you're saying that under this, you'd be able to put in this, what you call this extensive 20-year history of the entire... And the judge would say, well, that's all. I mean, what would be the judge's gatekeeper role in there? Just to say, well, this sounds plausible.
I think if you look at Bedford, for example, where this court decided, no, it doesn't sound plausible, the court simply reviewed the evidence and agreed with the trial court that there was contradictions to the defendant's testimony in support of his attempt to get McMorris evidence before. I think that is purely and simply it. Does it sound plausible? Is it something that a jury could accept? And then, as gatekeeper of the evidence, it should go into evidence, and at the end of trial, a determination made whether it should go to the jury on an instruction.
Well, in a preliminary, the test is the grounds to believe that a crime has been committed and by the defendant, right? So what are the grounds here? What's the test the trial court's going to use to determine whether or not there's a sufficient basis for self-defense?
Is there evidence supportive of self-defense within the defendant's testimony and including the history, if that's obviously going to be involved, if it's a McMorris question?
No, of course, the judge would be looking at remoteness. And the flavor you want to give to this is, you know, I want to show 20 years of abusing the wife. That's what you want to show, so that the jury hears that. Does that sound, is this really all relevant that you're going to go back that long? What? And the judge has to have more than a plausibility weapon that is his or her side to make a decision. That's what I'm getting. What do you want in this test? What?
I argued in our briefs, and I believe it is supportive of this test, that the court should be satisfied that the subjectively reasonable standard has been met.
Not objective.
Not
subjective standard.
Subjectively standard.
And how does Camacho then play out?
Well, Camacho comes into play when the jury's instructed. Camacho comes into play when the court has heard all of the evidence and can determine, can a jury reasonably find that the lesser included rather than the greater offense.
So as I understand the play here, you want the jury to hear it all, and then the judge to come out and define it, what they shouldn't take into account in the instruction.
Yes.
Well, that's a...
The judge at the instruction, there's nothing that prevents the judge from determining at that time that the jury should not be instructed on the lesser included.
Yeah, well, that, by that time, the jury's got the appropriate flavor, correct?
Which they did not have here, yes. And in fact, what they had here were hints of it with no explanation, which I think is a worse situation than if they hear it and then the judge determines at the end, well, perhaps we should not instruct on that. It may be rare. Certainly there's cases in this court's history where the trial court did instruct on self-defense but denied that there should be McMorris evidence. We're a little bit all over the map on that. I think what's crucial here is that the jury heard such things as I shot because I was afraid, but because they were denied the instruction on self-defense, could do nothing with that.
Counsel, I want to return to my inquiry concerning the amicus brief, because I just need some clarification on your argument. I heard you just say in response, I argued in my brief that this will be met when this being the test for showing, when the subjective component is met. Okay, I need help on this. I think under Camacho, and it seems to me that there's some agreement here that you need both the subjective and the objective on the element. Is that correct? And what the first element or one of the elements?
On the elements for self-defense, perfect and imperfect.
Okay.
Yes.
You need both subjective and objective. Now, is your argument that subjective to establish a prima facie case? Evidence, of course, is sufficient to establish the subjective component. But is your argument also that subjective is sufficient to establish a prima facie case for objective?
No.
When you say, I argued in my brief, this will be met when subjective is shown, what do you mean by that?
The McMorris test, that's met by the subjective reasonable view that the defendant had. If the court listens to the testimony, finds it plausible factually, and if a subjective or objective level is needed, subjectively the defendant has met that because it is plausible, because it is easy to see that in her mind she had a need for self-defense, that then the McMorris standard that this court has set and needs to clarify, I think, has been met.
So you're adopting both McMorris subjective and Camacho objective.
I'm not disputing that the Camacho objective comes into play in self-defense cases. I don't believe it comes...
That's your issue, really.
Correct. Correct. I'm not here to overturn Camacho.
You don't care about that as much as ultimately getting in this kind of evidence.
What the threshold requirement is to get in this evidence.
Yes. Yes.
Except the only way the trial judge can decide the McMorris issue is by reference to whether or not the case is a self-defense case in the first instance, right? Because that's the only way McMorris evidence is relevant.
Correct.
So the judge has to make a threshold pretrial determination about self-defense and whether that's going to be an issue that's litigated in the case or not before getting to the McMorris admissibility issue.
But if the objective view is required at that point in the midst of trial, how close is that to taking the issue away from the jury incorrectly?
Well, it's not if it's a very low threshold, as you're arguing and as the fallback position of the amicus is arguing.
Yes.
That you've got to have some basic showing that there's enough to make this a self-defense case, and then we'll litigate the admissibility of McMorris.
That's correct.
Is that your fallback position as well, I guess?
My true fallback position is, if the court determines it's an objective level test for McMorris, it was met here, or I should say conversely, the trial court didn't conduct that analysis. My true fallback is that the trial court here did not exercise its discretion in determining whether this McMorris evidence...
So regardless of the position you want to remand back to trial court and tell them?
Yes. Yes. I know this court took the case on for a reason, and my purpose here today is just to see that there's a reversal so that this evidence can be offered to a jury so that they can determine whether Deborah had acted in self-defense. And that's why I do not seek to overturn Camacho, and I do not believe Camacho plays into the McMorris test in the way that the state is arguing. Partly based upon the language of this court's opinions, which will change after this case, I'm certain.
How long did the defendant have the weapon in her hand before she fired it?
I believe the testimony, Your Honor, is that minutes went by with a discussion further about the Chad issue, the pregnancy issue. A minute or several minutes was her testimony after picking up the gun.
And how much time elapsed between the two shots?
A witness outside of the house, a child, said there was a second or two. Mrs. Head also said there was a second in between shots. Her testimony was the second shot was caused by the body moving back up, which she believed meant he was still coming towards me. I think Dr. Huntington was the person at trial who said you should never underestimate a wounded animal, and that may have been akin to her reaction to being shooting the second time.
But can you differentiate, or should we differentiate at all, between this large man using his body as a weapon before the first shot? Second shot.
As it goes to her state of mind, there should be no difference. In other words, it is still what was, according to her testimony, at play in her. It still goes to her state of mind in the first shot and the second shot.
Isn't that ultimately for the jury anyway?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And that's the ultimate question, is indeed that the jury should receive this evidence and then determine whether it was actually in self-defense, which they weren't given that opportunity. I see that my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Highland. Mr. Wren, Assistant Attorney General Wren, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Christopher Wren. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State Department of Justice, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this case. The state has two principal positions in this case. The first one, as I hope I made clear in my brief, is simply that this is not a self-defense case. Regardless of how much evidence she wanted to introduce on the McMorris principle, self-defense is not what was happening in this case. When Deborah had pulled that trigger twice, she was not acting in self-defense. Her own testimony, and it doesn't matter which of the several evolving versions of her testimony you want to believe, shows that at the time she committed the fatal acts, she controlled the situation. She believed she controlled the situation. Her husband believed she controlled the situation. Her husband was unarmed. He was terrified, in her words, and we know he was lying under the covers. She perpetuated, after she got the gun, she perpetuated for anywhere from 1 to several minutes the same conversation, the same circumstances that she claimed led her to believe she was in fear of her life. Under these circumstances, it's the state's view that a reasonable person, and that's the test, a reasonable person, the objective test, we don't dispute that all this evidence, McMorris, whatever she wanted to bring in, would have satisfied the subjective prong of the Camacho test, but that a reasonable person, the objectively reasonable person in Deborah Head's position, would not have reasonably perceived any response by Harold at that point as constituting an existing or imminently threatened unlawful interference with Deborah. By that point, Deborah had become the aggressor, committing an unlawful interference on Harold, and the privilege of self-defense had passed to Harold. His reputation for violence, whether he was the meekest guy in the world or whether he was the most violent guy in the world, at that point, he was in the defensive position and had a right to exercise self-defense.
How do you know that?
As a matter of law, we're basically saying that anybody who shoots an unarmed person can never assert a self-defense. And that's what you're basically asking us to say. And that's, as I read the trial court's opinion, the principal reason why he denied the self-defense instruction in this case was because she shot an unarmed man.
I think that as I read it, the judge was saying that none of the circumstances, none of the three circumstances existed at the time that would justify self-defense. Either an imminent overt threat, a violent conflict at that time, an assault, an actual assault, or the presence of a weapon. None of those things, which it discerned as the thread that ran through all the self-defense cases, existed. What I think a lot of the cases on which the McMorris evidence was introduced or was sought to be introduced in this case arose out of provocation cases, not self-defense cases. And I think that creates a separate kind of context for dealing with this thing. I think that in a sense, as a matter of law, there are certain circumstances below which the evidence that you can't have a self-defense case. And our position is that when a person has a gun, when a person is in control of the situation, when the victim is unarmed, lying in bed, and the person who has the weapon is perpetuating the circumstances that allegedly caused the need to pull up the gun in the first place, that the dynamic has shifted.
Is there a duty to retreat under those circumstances?
Well, that presents an interesting question, because I know that in Miller versus State, the court, this court recognized that there's no common law duty to retreat, but the issue of the duty to retreat tends to arise in contexts where a person has a right to be where he is, and in this case, both of them had a right to be where they were. But it also, but a duty to an obligation to disengage, to retreat, however we want to characterize it, is not available to somebody who is responsible for the condition that exists, for the circumstances which the person claims gave rise to self-defense. In this case, the state's position is that Deborah Head, while standing there, I want to clarify and make clear what I said in the brief, because the state does not dispute that at the time when Mr. Head made his statement and then appeared to her to move towards this gun, state does not dispute that at that point she had a right to self-defense to pick up that gun. The question is, what happened after she picked up the gun? It's analogous, in my view, to the District of Columbia case that we cited, where the boyfriend wrested the gun from his girlfriend's hand after she had pointed it at him, and at that point took the gun and pointed it at her and threatened her. The court said that up to the point where he wrested the gun away, it was self-defense. After that point, he was the aggressor. Similar situation here. Up to the point where she obtained control of the gun, it's the state's view that they were sort of an equipoise, that at the very least, we would acknowledge that she would have had a right up to that point for self-defense. But after she gets the gun, takes control of the situation, he's unarmed, lying in bed, she knows he's terrified and control. We see the dynamic of the situation is shifting to self-defense.
Well,
isn't there a dispute about whether he was still lying in bed at that point? I thought her testimony was going to be, and in fact was, that he kept coming after she picked up the gun.
Actually, the testimony of Dr. Huntington, when he described the trajectory of the bullets, and I don't have that, I had that before, but I don't have it immediately handy, testified that the first shot was consistent with him sitting up, which is the only time that she testified he was sitting up. That bullet tore off the top of his heart. At that point, he fell back, and the second bullet, as Dr. Huntington testified, was consistent with him lying down. So at that point, he's lying in the bed. So when he sat up, that's the point at which she claimed that she had the right of self-defense.
Oh, I'm sorry, finished.
So I don't know if I've answered the question.
Counsel, the reason I interjected is, but Dr. Huntington may have testified that, but she testified to a little different scenario, that he kept coming, made motions coming towards her.
I believe I would take the position that is that in the face of uncontradicted medical testimony that was physically impossible. That would be, in effect, almost judicially noticeable in the sense that he could not have been in the position that she's claiming he was when she shot the second bullet, and Dr. Huntington's testimony, they couldn't be consistent in that way.
But our focus has to be on what is the threshold requirement to establish a prima facie showing of being able to admit the McMorris self-defense evidence. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
And it seems to me that you might have Huntington testifying one way and you may have the defendant testifying the other way. But if our focus is on what is the threshold showing to establish a prima facie factual basis,
sure.
But that's different than what's the greater weight of the credible evidence, isn't it?
Well, in a sense, but if the credible evidence has not been contested by I mean, he's offering expert testimony based on physics, laws of physics, and her statement that he was apparently sitting up, or she was describing him as sitting up at the time of the second bullet. If that is contradicted by uncontested physical evidence that says that couldn't have been. I don't think we're talking about this threshold thing. I think that a court, an appellate court or a trial court, can say we have to accept that testimony that's already in.
Don't doctors ever make mistakes?
They did, but it wasn't contested in this case. I mean, that was already in at the time that, in terms of making a threshold showing, the trial judge has to make an evaluation as to what is going to constitute the threshold for the McMorris evidence. And at the point at which this came in, that was testimony that was uncontradicted and was part of all the evidence that the judge has heard at the time that she presented her McMorris evidence.
Well, what bothers me about your statement is, okay, I've got the gun. I've got him within, 6 feet, roughly?
She says at the offer of proof, she said 6 feet. By the time she testified a few minutes later, it had moved to 2 feet.
And we all know people don't estimate footage very well. If I asked you what the distance between the two of us, you and I would probably disagree. So when does she get back the right of self-defense? She doesn't have it when she's got the gun and he's lying in bed, okay? What does she have to do, put down the gun and say whoever gets it first is the non-aggressor or the aggressor? I mean, when does she get back self-defense? Does she have to back, this is going to what Justice Sykes, back out the house, the door, and get out of the house and risk his running after her with one of his 26 guns?
Right. I understand that all the 26 unloaded guns, that were, if he wanted to load them, I think she would have been well down the street by that time.
Mm-hmm.
I think, in part, from my perspective anyway, sort of a problem with this case is that it's been set up in the context of a battered woman kind of syndrome, even though this evidence clearly does not satisfy a battered woman syndrome kind of situation. I came to view this as essentially a bar fight that moved into the bedroom. We had two people with a long, troubled relationship. You could put this in a bar with two people, similar characteristics, big guy, small guy, one with a meek temper, one with a heavy-duty temper. A small argument erupts into a virulent confrontation. Whatever rule this court establishes in this case is going to govern those bar fights. And the question is, in a bar fight, do we want somebody to be able to take the gun and hold it on somebody and continue a conversation at gunpoint for several minutes without doing something else to at least indicate some effort to de-escalate the situation? Because if this becomes the rule that it's okay to hold a gun on somebody of disparate size and continue the situation that already existed that supposedly created this great fear in the defendant, we're going to have a lot of bar fights that are going to be governed by this rule. And I don't think that we want a rule. I think we want something, not so much a duty to retreat, but at least in a situation where it's clear from the defendant's perspective and from a victim's perspective, that the situation has come into the control of the person with a gun, some indication on the part of the person with a gun of an intention, of a desire to de-escalate, if nothing more than say, stay there, don't move. We don't have anything like this. What we have is a continuation of the thing that was causing the virulent reaction by the victim in the first place.
Why would we be establishing a rule if we were to simply say that the evidence should come in and let the jury decide?
I think because under the standard that's been proposed, what we're looking at is simply satisfying the subjective standard. And that, in effect, what it says is all the defendant has to do is say, I was afraid. And everything related to that, in effect, comes in. That's basically the idea that all of this McMorris evidence becomes relevant to the state of mind. And in this case, it's a 22-year tail of evidence that becomes relevant. If it doesn't satisfy the objective standard, you get to the end of the trial, and the judge is saying, well, I've heard all this, the jury's heard all this, but it's not relevant to anything we're going in. You've in effect, I think, tainted the jury pool. You've tainted the juror as they're listening. They're supposed to unring this bell. And I don't think you can do that. I think one of the things you need to do is have a principle by which you can have a threshold cutoff based on the facts that are testified to.
And what is that principle?
I think self-defense is very fact-specific. I think the principle is, in the context of this case, is that where you have situations where both people are battling, where there's contested evidence about who took the first shot and so on. Those are the kinds of things, I think, where you resolve it in favor of going to the jury. When you're trying to introduce McMorris evidence, you're trying to introduce evidence on the defendant's subjective state of mind. So you look to what the defendant is defining as the subjective state of mind, what it is that's causing this fear.
Okay, counsel, if that's the case, and I ask the opposing counsel just what would come into the case, what you're looking at 20 years of supposed abuse here, what would be your cutoff as far as what the judge is going to, we're now using McMorris, which you've acceded to, and what gets if anything, in this case? Certainly, would you get in the incident of that particular morning? You would say not.
No, the defendant certainly gets to testify about what happened, and the judge let that right. happen in this case. What happened at the moment, because the judge's position was that that with self-defense, the question is the imminence of the threat, the imminence of the presence of a weapon, the presence of a violent confrontation at the moment the privilege of self-defense is invoked. In this case, the state's position is that for McMorris evidence, because she has defined what her subjective state of mind is, and that's all McMorris evidence goes to, our position is that the only McMorris evidence that is relevant in this case, that possibly is relevant in this case, is evidence about Harold from the point at which he learned about his daughter's pregnancy until the time of his death. Because she says, without contradiction, that the thing that triggered her fear was the linkage between her and Chad. The only time that the first point at which any linkage of that sort could have occurred was on Valentine's Day weekend in 1998, when Harold had learned of his daughter's pregnancy. She doesn't talk about anything in terms of all this long chain. We have she testifies about these things, but when she talks about what it was that triggered her fear, what it was that triggered her need to exercise self-defense, it was the linkage with Chad and the fear that he was going to do to her what he was threatening to do to Chad.
Isn't that just a little too antiseptic for real life? I mean, homicides, shootings occur in all sorts of, you know, factually ambiguous situations, and we're being asked, your position is basically that the judge rules as a matter of law on these things based on what is a pretty high threshold, instead of relying on the jury to make these credibility calls about whether her story about why she did what she did and whether it was objectively reasonable stands up based upon the conflicting evidence. And as I understand the defense argument, they're saying it should be a very low, and the amicus argument is that it should be a low threshold decided pretrial when the judge is deciding whether it's a self-defense case in the first instance and whether McMorris evidence is going to come in on the issue of self-defense, and then you would let it go to the jury.
Our position is not that it's a high level. It would be the same level that would be used to decide whether the defense goes to the jury at all. Because if it doesn't rise to that level, if looking at the evidence that's introduced at trial, the judge still has to make a determination about whether a reasonable jury could have concluded that she was acting in self-defense.
Right, but typically we don't make those kind of credibility calls. I mean, much of what you're arguing sounds to me like a closing argument to the jury. You know, the trajectory of the bullet doesn't support her story that he was sitting up. It supports the state's theory that he was lying down when the second shot was fired. I mean, all of that is typical closing argument stuff on the credibility of her story.
It might very well be, but I'm not talking, but she's the only one who's testified. I can put aside what Dr. Huntington said. Just looking at her testimony, I'm perfectly happy to look just at her testimony, and particularly just the testimony that she offered at the offer of proof, because that's the McMorris evidence question. The evidence she offered at the trial was unequivocal. She was afraid because of the linkage with Chad, not because of the 22 years of whatever she wants, whether she wants to call this abuse or physical confrontation, however we want to characterize. She said that the thing that triggered that fear was the linkage to Chad. There's no linkage to Chad before Valentine's Day of 1998. The other things, from her own testimony, can't be relevant. I mean, that's all McMorris is about. McMorris is about the subjective state of the defendant's mind. That's what she testified to.
Counsel?
There is no conflict in the testimony.
I want to return to Justice Babbage's question, or at least a variation on that theme. Opposing counsel has given us the test they proposed. What is the necessary threshold showing to allow the evidence to go to the jury? What must be established to make a prima facie showing that McMorris evidence should go to the jury? What's that standard? I want to write it down to make it sound legalese.
Well, the threshold for certainly the only threshold required for getting an offer of proof is just to say, I want to introduce it, and to have a plausible explanation that you had a fear of the subject. So it sort of turns Camacho upside down, because you look to the defendant and say, did you have a fear? Yes. Okay, we're going to have a hearing on this.
Can you give it to me in a sentence or two? Yeah. Showing necessary to establish a prima facie facts to allow McMorris evidence to go to the jury?
Well, in order to avoid having irrelevant evidence go to the put in front of the jury, I think it has to be judged by the same standard as, in effect, what evidence would be permissible to go in front of the jury to get the self-defense instruction in front of them.
So you're saying the threshold showing to establish prima facie factual basis is the same as the showing at the end of the trial necessary to establish the requested jury instructions?
That's the way I would characterize it, because I think that otherwise you wind up with a raft of irrelevant evidence, potentially prejudicial evidence, coming in based on the pretrial offer of proof by which the judge would say, you get to bring this in.
I need a little more help with that, because I just look at the continuum, you know, of the threshold showing in order to put forth testimony. And then, of course, you're talking about after all the testimony is in, at the end of all the testimony, the jury instruction conference, what do you need? It just seems like that's a much different standard, but you want them to be the same standard.
I think that by the time the issue, and I'm not disputing that that the evidence has to be viewed from the most favorable position vis-a-vis the defendant. But what I am saying is that even when you're getting ready to go to trial, the judge has to, going to the jury instruction conference and to present, to decide what, how the jury is going to get instructed, you have to make a determination at that point. And it is, in effect, a determination of law, whether a reasonable jury, based on the evidence that's been introduced, could conclude that that the defendant had the privilege, potentially could have had the privilege of self-defense. I don't see that why that should be any different for the offer of proof, which is intended to decide what evidence could come in to establish, to deal with self-defense.
Well, I may go along with you, but I still don't know what that is. That's what the problem is. I mean, you say it's the law, but I don't know what law. Now, you said when you began, this is not a self-defense case.
That's our
position. As a matter of law, you don't ever, if there's a showing like there is in this case, it's out. All this evidence is out because it's not a self-defense. And I wrote down, it's not a self-defense because there is no existing or imminent threat of violence or danger, right?
Testimony, yes.
That's your standard. Is that your response to Justice Babbage and to Justice Bradley, that's your standard?
Well, I confess I don't know that I have a standard other than the one that a judge would use to decide whether it goes to court.
Well, we'll double back. What would a judge use?
That, I'm afraid I, off the top of my head, I...
We can look at one of these, let's see, what opinion has it? I think it's Rogensack's opinion, has a list. This is what she says. Prevail on the issue of self-defense, a defendant must show all three of the following elements. Blue brief, page, appendix 177. I mean, I think that's what I don't want to speak for my colleagues. That's what I'm driving at. I want to know, judge sits there in this preliminary, you agree there should be a preliminary proceeding in which offer of proof is made, and then the judge decides whether to let in the evidence, right?
Yes.
Okay. But the judge is not tied ultimately to give an instruction because you don't know how the evidence is going to come in, right? Okay. So we agree on the procedure, that is the state and the defendant?
So.
Okay. So now we're at this preliminary hearing, and what I'm looking for is what does the trial court judge have in front of her that she can test this offer of proof? To prevail on the issue of self-defense, a defendant must show all three of the following elements. Now, you don't have to agree with this, but at least it starts the conversation.
Can you tell me what paragraph this is for?
Yeah, sure. Paragraph 29.
Got it.
It's the indented quoted part. Defendant reasonably believed he was preventing or terminating unlawful interference with a person. The defendant reasonably believed the force or threat thereof was necessary to prevent or terminate the interference. And three, the defendant reasonably believed that the actual amount of force used was necessary to prevent or terminate. Then Judge Rogensack says, the first element of the three-part test has two components, subjective, what the defendant believed from the defendant's perspective, and objective, what the reasonable person, similarly situated, would have believed. An imperfect self-defense also requires proof of the first element. Now, is that what you had in mind?
Well, that's the Camacho standard. That's the standard for, I think, going to the jury. Yes,
But is that what you want the trial judge to think about when she hears the offer of proof?
She hears the offer of proof, and to the extent that there's any dispute, to the extent that a jury could infer different things from that evidence, you resolve it in favor of the defendant and in favor of sending it to the jury. And my position is, the state's position is, that in this situation, her testimony establishes a situation, establishes facts that don't rise to that objective level, to the reasonable person standard, that the judge, in order to decide whether it's going to go to the jury, has to look at.
But doesn't 940.01 sub 2b say that if the belief is objectively unreasonable, it mitigates it from first to second degree? So at the very least, the defendant's going to get an instruction on imperfect or incomplete self-defense?
But that gets the subjective component, I think.
I think it says if either belief was unreasonable.
Right.
And that Camacho didn't address that, but that's the statute under which this defendant was tried, right?
But But I, as I understood Camacho, that the part about the unreasonable belief and that the belief in the need for force was unreasonable, that component of it is part of the subjective test. And what I'm trying to deal with is the question of the objective standard. And I know.
Okay. And I'm asking you about that. Doesn't the statute explicitly say that if either belief was unreasonable, in other words, if there's a failure of objective reasonableness on either the imminent threat or the use of force, it mitigates it from first to second degree, at the very least?
Yes, it does.
It may not be a complete defense, but it mitigates.
Okay, maybe I'm.
Well, this calls into question Camacho, obviously, but I'm asking you about it.
Maybe I'm not perceiving this correctly, or maybe I'm just not articulating it adequately. But I perceive that unreasonableness, that reasonable slash unreasonableness standard, as something that comes up in the context of the subjective standard. That the objective standard is a reasonable person, starts with a reasonable person. You have to pass that threshold first. Then you get to the question of the subjective, the unreasonableness of the belief. I thought that that's what Camacho was saying in terms of how it's interpreting the self-defense statute. So maybe I'm misunderstanding Camacho, maybe I'm misunderstanding the self-defense statute, but it seems to me that this part of the statute you're referring to is the part that you get to once you've passed the objectively reasonable person test.
Well, whenever we're talking about applying a reasonable person test or whether something was reasonable under the law, isn't that always an objective test?
Yes, it is.
So when the statute says if either belief is unreasonable, it's referring to...
This is one of the conundrums, I think, that we run into, because even with a subjective test, there can be an objective component, whether there's an objective reasonableness to make it unreasonable. I appreciate your confusion with my answer, but if I'm confusing you, it may be because I wasn't able to discern from the case law itself a standard by which the Camacho test gets you over to the subjectively unreasonable, to the unreasonable belief part of that.
Well, you keep... I'm not sure this is worth emphasizing, but the way I have always thought about this is that there's got to be proof of a subjective belief in the imminent threat. In other words, they have to believe what she says. The jury has to believe what she says. I was afraid that I was going to be killed.
Yes.
And there has to be proof of a subjective belief in the use of force. I'm talking about the imperfect self-defense, the mitigation. Those things must be subjective. Those beliefs must be subjectively present, and that's always hard for a jury to decide because they can't get inside the defendant's head, but they have to find enough proof of her subjective beliefs on those two things, and then you get to the analysis of whether either of those was objectively reasonable under the circumstances, and if the jury says yes, then it's a full defense, a complete defense, perfect self-defense, and if the jury says no, then it's second-degree homicide.
Okay. I know that all I can say is that when we were scoping this out in the department, and I was working with some of our people and trying to trace out, and I actually did create a flow chart on this, based on Camacho, that was not the way I perceived Camacho as setting forth the test for getting self-defense instruction to the jury.
I think you may be right about that, but I'm asking, does that make any sense in light of what the statute says?
Well, if you're asking me if we should overrule Camacho, I don't think so. I'm sorry, but I don't have a pithy response to deal with what I agree is a very complex relationship between Camacho and the language of the self-defense statute.
That's good. That's artfully stated.
But I think, and this may be where the confusion lies in my perception and your perception as to how these things relate. I see Camacho as starting out by saying in so many words that the objective test is the threshold test. You don't even start to address the subjective component the defendant's actual belief until you've passed the reasonableness test. And it seems to me that the reasonableness test, in effect, is a in many respects, a question of law. I mean, you have...
Oh, sure.
So the judge, any judge that has to decide whether to submit a self-defense test is always making a reaching a conclusion of law as to whether the evidence construed most favorably to the defendant has reached the level to satisfy the subjective reasonableness test.
Chief, may I?
Yes.
I reread the transcript this morning. That's part of the blue brief, the appendix. My reading of the trial court's decision is that although he heard the history evidence and although he prefaced the beginning or part of his analysis with, I've considered the case law, I've considered the evidence presented to the standard kind of preference, that when it came to making his decision, at several times he indicated in the transcript that he felt that he was limited to only what was happening at the time, and that he discarded any prior information, any prior history. Do you think the trial court erred in its approach?
I think that in light of my accession, that the trial court probably did not take it into account the way it should have. Our position is that even if the trial court had taken it into account, that it still would not have reached.
That's what I mean, I really hear you saying, look, the trial, maybe you don't want to say it quite as strongly as I'm saying, the trial court erred in its approach, but that doesn't make any difference because there's still going to be, the result will be the same.
That's correct, and this court can recognize that.
Thank you, Mr. Wren. Mr. Harland?
Thank you. The state has made a concession here today, which I don't want to be unmissed, and that is that when Deborah had picked up the gun, she had a right of self-defense. I did not garner that from the briefs, but perhaps I missed it or didn't read between the lines, but I think that's crucial to this court's consideration, especially since the state now asks this court to create a new duty for individuals within our state, a duty to de-escalate. A duty, according to the state, if you are in that situation, to back off if you're holding the weapon. And I think that's where the McMorris evidence comes into play, and I think that's where the court below erred in not considering what Justice Bradley was just asking about. Deborah had testified that after this moment when Harold realized she was in control, that he went back to the same and worse attitude, anger, lack of control that he had before. And yes, they continued discussing the same subject, but I think it's common knowledge to think that this is a brief span of time with things happening repeatedly one right after another. Deborah had testified that he got more furious, his hands became like fists, he was the weapon, he was moving as if to get out of bed, and then she fired. And I don't see the state's argument panning out that she somehow lost that right simply because she should have backed off. The state analogizes this to a barroom fight. It was not a barroom. It was not a room filled with people who could intervene. It was not a large space. It was a small bedroom. It was a small enclosed space. She was in her night clothes. She was holding the weapon but knew that there were accessible weapons within reach. I think trial counsel loaded one of those weapons in front of the jury and pointed out that it took a matter of seconds for him, and it wasn't his weapon, it was Mr. Head's weapon.
Also, so you're understanding that in the concession that the state made, and we had called the opposing counsel's attention, A-177 in the blue brief, you know, the Rogensack dissent.
Yes.
Using that, what would be your, we asked about how far back, what type of testimony you would like to before the jury, understanding the quote elements in that, where would you go with that as far as the test?
As far as remoteness, Your Honor?
Right.
All of it. And I know that's the answer you probably expected me to say, because I'm advocating for the entire picture to go to the jury, because I think the entire history is relevant to her state of mind and whether it was reasonable.
So no matter what the judge does, and this is what I'm driving at as far as a quote instruction, limiting or otherwise, it's, you know, get it to the jury, it's in the jury's mind, and then the judge is going to have to give an instruction, although you heard testimony. Is that realistic?
Is it any less realistic than what happened here, where the jury heard testimony that would support self-defense but wasn't told anything about it? When the jury heard Mrs. Head say, I shot because I was afraid, end of story. We trust our juries to listen to instructions, we trust them to follow instructions, and we trust them to sift through the elements and the evidence and reach these very decisions. Yes, I think
Mr. Hyland, did this case go to the jury on both first degree and second degree intentional homicide?
No, Your Honor.
Solely first degree and not guilty.
Two verdict forms, that's correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, did you ask for second degree?
Yes, they did, and reckless, but we don't dispute that the ruling on reckless was correct.
You didn't get second degree because this evidence wasn't in, that, so it didn't substantiate it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Maybe the test should be for this evidence the same test that's used to allow the state to bring in other acts evidence.
It would make sense, Your Honor. It goes to subject state of mind, to those types of those very things the court has identified in Sullivan.
Could you respond a little bit more specifically to the suggestion that the rule that comes out of this case will apply to the bar fight situation?
I agree completely with the state. This is not an issue solely to cases involving domestic disputes. This is an issue to evidence in self-defense cases. And you could very well have, and I think the cases before the court involving perhaps Daniels, perhaps Bedford, if my recollection serves, involved non-domestic cases where a person knew the history, both as far as aggression towards themselves and hearing about it towards others, knew the history of the person they were involved with and acted in self-defense based on that. I think certainly this would apply in a bar fight. It's just that you do not have the volume of history here, which is why to Justice Wilcox I say the entire volume should come in. Just as if you have more limited volume in a bar fight, there's no reason why it's not appropriate to place it before the jury.
Well, that comes under the third element, doesn't it? The defendant reasonably believed that the actual amount of force used was necessary to prevent or terminate the interference.
Yes, and similarly for imperfect, that it was an unreasonable belief. Thank you. My time has expired. There's nothing
further. Thank you, Mr. Hyland. Thank you, Mr. Wren, for your arguments this morning. That concludes.